Welcome to the Unusual Creatures Podcast, a podcast about the unusual creatures that fall in love, stay, stray, come back, and sometimes leave this insane business of artistry and show.
Against all odds, our guests have persevered and told stories using their mediums of choice. Now, these are their stories. And our stories.
The incredible people who you might know by sight, whose names you may not recognize, whose work you've definitely experienced or will one day experience.
Art is a ripple effect, and these artists' creativity makes a lasting impact. Let's hear more.
Hello, hello, hello. Good evening, good night, good day, good morning. Hallelujah. Welcome, welcome, one and all. This is Thomas Dane.
And I'm Jenny Gomez.
And this is the Unusual Creatures Podcast.
It really is. It really is.
How are we feeling today, Jenny? Hello. It's our closing week of Pride.
I know.
Such a gay month.
It's been gay. I love to say it. It makes me so happy. It's been wonderful.
And happy gay.
Happy gay as well. I don't know if we want to get into the darkness, but we did just find out that Roe v. Wade got overturned this morning. So I'm trying not to have emotions about that. So I'm going to table my emotions. I'm going to put them on the shelf a little bit because we want this to be happy.
Tell me something good about the husband. Tell me something good about the husband this week.
The husband is in Puerto Rico. He travels a lot for work, so he's going to come back sun-kissed and sexy, and I can't wait to get him back home.
That sounds homophobic, but whatever. It's fine. Oh, no, I'm kidding. It's like the straights can have sex too during Pride. Absolutely. I am not one of those. Good. Well, hello, Sean. If you're listening, you should be listening as you're traveling. Hello, hello. Sending out newsletters for us in Puerto Rico. Come listen, Puerto Rico. Hello.
Hello, hello. Well, how are you doing, Tom?
I'm good. I'm alive. So that's a plus. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling happy. I'm feeling prideful. I've started to get back into exercise this week, and by that I mean just like walking up and down the stairs. So that's been like the pandemic really ruined any chance I had for anything like that for a while. So I stayed downstairs mostly. So now I'm trying to get back in a health kick, because even if we're living with this, it's time to get back to life, everybody. We can still start to stop. If you take it from me, don't make any more excuses. Get up, get moving, get fabulous, whatever that means for you. Listen to some Lizzo. You know?
Yeah. I think this podcast has really been inspirational when it comes to not making any fucking excuses. I think everybody that we've listened to that has continued to do what they do and like move their art into the world and keep pushing and fighting for their creativity just doesn't make any fucking excuses. So let that be an unusual creature's lesson.
And I think that is the great segue into today's guest, don't you?
I do. Yes. This is going to be a fantastic episode, and I'm super excited. We met this person actually, and if you listen to the podcast, you know that we went to Austin, Texas for the Outlier Podcast Festival. So
and it was hot as hell.
It was hot as hell. Shout out to our Outlier Podcast Festival family, and we got blessed with the presence of this fantastic guest. They are a podcaster, a stand-up comedian, an actor, a writer, of course. They're bisexual.
They're a mother.
We're going to talk about their podcast. This guest is a superstar in the podcast world and also a superstar stand-up comedian. They're Austin, Texas based. But why don't we let them talk about themselves? How does that sound, Tom?
Amen. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the fabulous Ivy Lee. Hello, Ivy.
Howdy do from Austin, Texas.
Yay! It is a motherfucking pleasure to have you on, Ivy. Thanks so much for joining us.
You were a highlight of the entire podcast. I mean, we had a good time, and I didn't know what to expect. But I don't know. I just walked in, and you were such a breath of fresh air. You were just so authentically you and funny and knowledgeable. And just, I was like, we have to have her. Let's get her.
I know you needed that fresh air, too, because it was hot when you're all down there. It's hot down here now.
Ooh. It must be hot as Hades down in Texas right now. It's summer.
Especially my podcast closet with no air conditioning.
I can't. I
literally have ice packs between my thighs right now. You know those cold ice packs that you put in coolers? I'm holding one between my thighs.
The glamorous world of podcast recording, ladies and gentlemen. Bless. We like to always start the show now that people sort of know a little bit about you from the intro, but we like you to talk about you a little bit. And we always start with, honey, what is your villain origin story? Why? Who is Ivy Lee? And what made you choose these crazy creative careers?
For me, I don't know if I really chose the arts so much as the economy is not very kind to women of color. Children of immigrants in the United States.
No, you're kidding. So, no, please.
You know, my parents came to America in 1980 as refugees from the Vietnam War. And I was the first American, like native born American born in my family. And so I think growing up, I just was a very competitive writer. I cared very much about writing. I cared a lot about the English language because I was the only one who could speak English, you know, for a really long time until more people in my family were born and got older or immigrated to the United States and had been there longer. So for a long time, I was super paranoid because I didn't read something, you know, my family was going to miss out on something incredibly important, like the rapture something like that.
On the baby aspirin. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I didn't read the flyer that somebody put on our door, you know, because it's all going to be my fault. And really my extracurricular, it wasn't theater or band or any of those. It was just plain visual art. I think if I had been born in a different time or place or dimension, if the world were already more just, or if I wasn't aware that the world was not unjust, I probably would have been a sculptor, just, you know, not speaking a word all day and being perfectly happy about it.
Interesting.
Instead, yeah, I write because you don't need to have money to be the best writer at your school. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, it was the only thing I could afford to be good at my school.
Yeah. Because you didn't need to invest in a ton of clay or a studio. You just needed a paper and a pen.
Well, in art class, I didn't have to spend. I mean, art supplies are expensive, but my approach to art was always very much just using what I could find and making the most of it, you know? Whereas, like, you know, there is kind of a minimum amount of money that your family has to have to be in band, or you have to travel for choir. You have to, you know, like all these other extracurriculars that you have to sign up for are like extremely expensive. Whereas art, you can kind of, you know, like if you don't have the money, you're not going to be maybe, you know, the most standout student in your class or whatever, but you can still, you know, make things from what you've got. Really, at the end of the day, even in art class, as long as you can also hold a pencil. I mean, that's what I had a lot of, okay? It's just pencils.
I'm wondering too... So much of it too is that all the schools, they don't give a shit about art anyway. So they're not going to, they don't send the drama club all over the country like they do the cheerleading squad and everything else. So it's like, oh, artists, yeah, go ahead, just because they don't care about us until we reach a certain point.
I don't know that I always thought of myself as an artist so much as I think if I wasn't creative, I would probably be dead by now. I think for me, entrepreneurship, creativity is resourcefulness. Like, that's just all part of the immigrant experience. You have them so that you can weather the storm or you don't, and then you don't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I find it interesting that you would be a sculptor if things had gone a different direction.
Yeah, I would think I'm a deeply creative person. I found that, I think when I was younger, I found it to be very much a burden. I don't think a whole lot of people in my family just understand. They don't have that just burning need. I don't even know what that is, drive. I wish I had more drive to make more money. But I can't stop myself from making things, right? If it's not writing something, it's sewing something, or it's inventing a new recipe for something, or it's, you know, making an experiential event for people I want to get together, or, you know, it's always something. I'm always making something. I used to think that was very burdensome when I was very young, because when I was in my 20s, I'm not in my 20s. I know I look it, but
she does.
I was going to say 18. Not a day over 18.
Yeah. I know I look like a damn teen mom, but actually a middle-aged woman. Don't worry. I still have like 2 fuckable years left in Hollywood, and I'm going as fast as I can. But I think when I was younger, I felt like a lot of my friends didn't have that. And so they would just work their really long entry-level jobs like all of us did. And then when they were done with work, they could go work out, go out to dinner, go clubbing, go do whatever, you know. And I was working an extremely demanding, you know, 50 to 60 hour job, entry level, just like everybody else. It's just this punishing job in PR. And then I would also go clubbing, you know, like 5 nights a week. But I was working 20 hours a week easily every week on poetry and magazine articles. I was always a freelance writer on the side, submitting to performing spoken word, just really hustling as hard as I could, because I just didn't have, I couldn't not do it. And so it was super stressful that everybody else seemed to be having so much more fun run than I was, and I just mm-hmm. couldn't chill out. Like, I just couldn't get off work and go work out and then hang out and chill, you know?
And go to the club. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Ooh. You were like, I have to go write. So writing was the first thing. You graduated college. Where were you working this entry-level job? Was this also in Austin, Texas?
No, that was all. My Reckless Youth was in Georgia. That was in Atlanta,
Georgia.
Georgia.
Ooh,
okay.
Atlanta.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you got out of college, got a job in a PR agency. What did you study in college?
Public relations and political science. I double majored.
Okay. All right. Ambitious as hell. Yeah, of course. Like, of love course that. And so you got your first job out of college in a PR agency.
It wasn't my first job. My first job was inside sales. I had to get a white front man to get a job at the PR agency.
Please tell me that story.
I was academic elite at the time in my Reckless Youth. The young people today are so incredible. There's no way that I could have gotten the full room and board tuition scholarship that I got back then today. Young people today are freaking incredible.
Yeah, yeah. The competition is bananas. Yeah.
The competition is no way. But we were dumber back then, and I was the smartest. Okay.
The bar was low.
We thought the world was going to end with Y2K. So I was able to get
I remember that year.
Yeah. I was able to get one of the most prestigious undergraduate scholarships in North America to the University of Georgia. It's called the Foundation Fellowship. You were a senior in high school. I highly recommend you checking that out. Or if you know a really promising young person, they should totally check it out. And so I only applied to colleges that had full rides. And my family was very, very poor. So I would never tell my parents how much the application fees were. I would negotiate with the representatives. I would call the admissions office and negotiate with them. And they were very amenable to it. You know, if they would just, most of them would just be like, okay, what's your SAT score? What's your GPA? And then, and it was high enough. And they would be like, all right.
What was your SAT score?
I mean, I don't remember now, but it was something. I do remember because my mom got it. Because I'm the only person in my family who went to college. My mom got it. We don't have privacy at my house.
Sure.
And with Roe v. Wade overturning, the rest of you are about to experience what it's like living in an Asian American household. My mom just opened the letter and she was like, you know, nobody in my family's taken an SAT before, right? And so my mom's just like, what's the highest score you can get? And back then the highest score you could get was a 1600. And then she was just like, huh. And she throws it on the table and she's like, where's the other 80 points?
Oh, here we go.
No, it's not like that though. It's not like that.
No.
I just smiled and I said, fucked up, Ma.
Yeah.
I was like, I fucked up, Ma. I just shrugged. I was like, I don't know what to tell you. I fucked up.
I wrote my name wrong. Points. I don't know.
Yeah. Or maybe it was 60 points. Or she's like, where were the other 60 points? I think it was 60. She was like, where are the other 60 points?
No big deal, Ivy Lee. No big deal.
1540. I'm like, that's right? Like, I mean, I don't even, I can't even, I was going to say my score, but now I won't. And I'm like, oh, no way.
Tom is wildly humbled.
The stakes were very high, right? If I didn't have that, there's no way I would have been able to go to college. So the stakes were very high for me.
Sure.
So I was academic elite, double majored. I think at that time I spoke three languages. I didn't know how to speak German yet. And now I do. But back then I spoke three. I had an award-winning thesis about public diplomacy. I interned at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Budapest. And my thesis was about their PR efforts abroad when they were trying to convince the EU to let that Eastern Bloc of countries join. And I could not get an interview anywhere. So my first job was just this inside sale. I had to make like 100 cold calls a day. It was like an inside sales job where we were recruiters for like restaurant employees or something like that. And it was it was fun. It was commission. It was good. I didn't have any college debt at the time, but I didn't have any money either, you know. So I was like, give me something with a lot of commission because I just need to get set up in Atlanta and have my Reckless Youth.
Right.
So then I started dating a white man who was in law school with a girl who was sorority sisters with the internship coordinator at one of the big PR agencies in Atlanta. And so then they interviewed me for the internship, realized that I was, of course, wildly overqualified. And so usually how it works is you have to have a white front man.
You do need a white front man.
Yeah. And I've been except for when I went into the nonprofit sector, I was the first or one time second minority in a non-support staff role at every organization I've ever worked.
And I still feel like I work in a pink collar job because I work in marketing. It's like HR, marketing, finance, none of the big shit, you know?
No, I just wouldn't know. I've only worked pathetic jobs. So you guys, I've always been with the menial white guys doing nothing. So I don't know. The high powered places are scared me. So
I guess you're not responsible for your parents' retirement then.
No. I've always been broke because I went straight into the arts. I went straight, you know, I went to film school. I went from acting in high school to film school, then back to acting. So I never, like, going for high powered jobs and gigs was even when I should have. I was like, I've always just been poor. Go on.
Well, yeah, Ivy, because I'm curious too, because you said, like, you know, while you're still trying to have your reckless youth in Atlanta, working these jobs out of college, you said you still spent 20 hours a week writing poetry, going to slam poetry, like open mic. Like, what, why was that the thing? Like, why was that the, why were you spending all of this time doing all of that when you could have just been out partying with your friends and going to the gym? Like, I know you said you just feel like you had to, but what was the goal at that point? Because you got the big, you're at the PR agency,
right?
Like, you have the job, you're paying the bills a little bit, like
a little bit. Yeah. Sweet millennial money.
Yes.
I have lived through multiple recessions. First of all, I don't like working out.
Well, there's that. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
So that's a non-starter. I'm just sure. Not a very physically impressive person. You know, I have the build of a poet. There is that. And I don't remember. I think there's just some part of me that just said, you know, it would be really great if I could be a writer. And I am a hard ass Asian mom. And that's before I had kids. I've always been a hard ass Asian mom. If you come up to me and you're like, oh, I'm a writer too. And I'm like, oh, what if, yo, like, tell me about what you've been writing. You know, I want to talk sharp. I'm super interested in your creative process. But like, 4 out of 5 people who say that have like literally not written anything in a decade, like not so much as like, you know, a poem on the back of a napkin. And I'm just like, okay, this is a super awkward.
You know, at the recession we went through, where was it? Was it 2010 or wherever? Because we were waiting tables in New York at the time, and I worked at a restaurant in the heart of the financial district. And I used to get so aggravated because these uppity white, mostly, who were working in finance. Because I have always said, like, finance is where the frat boy goes to die. That's all I met down there. And I remember, like, 5 out of 10 of them were like, you know, over here, like, you know, this is really great, actually, because I'm gonna finally write my book. And I was like, let me understand. So I was like, as if like this is just something I'm just gonna write a book because I'm so fucking interesting, because I'm so brilliant. I'm like, oh, I wanted to push him in the Hudson. I was like, tell me what you've written so far.
I mean, I'm all about put your goals out there, you know, like, you know, make yourself accountable to the things that you say. That's totally fine. I don't want people to have imposter syndrome, but I think what you were experiencing was a bunch of imposters. Like, it's not a syndrome if you're literally faking it. It's not a syndrome. You're just an imposter.
Yes.
But I think a lot of times that people on the imposter syndrome side just feel like, oh, I haven't gotten approval from the white man yet. Therefore, I'm not really an auteur, or I'm not really a writer or a podcaster or whatever. Right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of, there's nuance to it. Like, if you're doing it, you are it, whether or not people have validated you or not. And if you're not doing it, then you're not it. That's just, you know, you don't have to be afraid to try. I feel like people are so hung up with failure when I'm like, you're not even going to get to the point where you can call yourself a failure. Do you know what I mean?
Like, totally. Yeah.
You're not even like
you have to fucking do something first to fail at it.
Fail. Yeah. Nice. You can't, like, people are so worried about becoming failures. I'm like, that's so not your problem right now. Like, you're not even to the point where you could even call yourself a quitter. Like, you're not even, trying to get yourself to the point where somebody would say, oh, they were this and they quit, you know,
right.
And they quit when things got good, or they quit because it got hard. Like, most people never get to the point where anybody could even call them a quitter, much less a failure, you know?
Like, you're still in finance, sir. You're nothing. Get out of here.
Like, did you really, you know, fail if you never finished a draft? Do you know? Did you really fail? You know, did you really like fail at something if all you did was like a few Google searches? You know, like, people shouldn't be afraid to fail. Like, failure in this context is an achievement. Very few people, I think, have the have been initiated into the club of people who have like genuinely failed at something. And I don't know, maybe it's because my parents are war refugees, but I think the smoking wreckage of my failures is funny.
That's the title for your book. Like, that's like the smoking wreckage of my failures. That's great.
It's funny. Yeah. Oh, I love that so much. We talk a lot about like that there is, you absolutely have to fail. Like you have to fail in order to do this quote unquote right. Like whatever your medium is as an artist, you have to fuck it up a few times before I think you get to a point where you're like, okay, we talk about Liz Claman, the photographer. She was a fine art photographer when she started and she failed a bunch. Like we asked her, what was your work? What was your good work? When you were a fine art photographer, she's like, there was none. It's all shit. You know? And now she's a culinary photographer and she's quite successful. She pays all of her bills, taking beautiful pictures. And now she doesn't consider herself an artist anymore because she's like, I'm a creative technician. And isn't that the irony? Once you finally reach a point of succeeding, then you're just a technician.
It's funny because I have a question I can broach to the three of us, and because I'm wondering if it's just an American issue or if it's a human species issue. We're built on a foundation of learning that failure is not an option from very young. I mean, I know because I had, when you were talking about the SAT points, I remember I used to bring home 95s and my mother would be like, where's the other 5 points? What do you mean? You know, I worked hard for that 95. Is this an American thing? Is it just, we're just driven to think failure is not an option?
I disagree that's an American thing at all. I think in the world, for some people, failure is not an option. I mean, some people get more chances to fail than others. That's just, I mean, the world is not just, you know, like some fair. People get to fail, right. And some people don't. And I think that is why, that is the real reason I think why a lot of people are afraid to fail, because they know damn well that they're not one of the people who's going to get a whole lot of chances to do that. And that's very real. And I totally understand that, which is why, and it's specifically to those people that I'm like, just do it, you know, like just do it. I think in America, I've had the great privilege to travel all over the world. And, you know, I'm from an immigrant community, so I know a lot of immigrants and can compare and contrast, you know, in different places. And I think in America, we are totally allowed to fail. I hate it here and I love it here. You know, I just, that's how you feel about the place that you love. I've never known another home. I'm super Southern, right? And what I realize as a writer, you know, having access to media and other languages, is that what makes this swaggering American action movie, or like what makes us what we are, is that we really don't care if you've failed. We really don't care how bad you've messed up in the past. If you've had a bankruptcy, your credit can bounce back. If you've had a really public failure, like your children are still, you know, your children are not going to get kicked out of school. If you've, you know, right, we're much more individualistic in that sense. And that's what kind of holds back other countries' media is they culturally are not willing to make their protagonists as deeply flawed as we're willing to make our protagonists, you know, because, and we're able to do that because Americans are willing to forgive almost anybody for almost anything as long as you get back up. You see it in the world. So I'm a big World Cup fan. I never watched soccer for the other 3 years. I only watch World Cup soccer. And I watch it, I like really get into it. Every game. I own a vuvuzela. I get the eye blacks for my teams.
I love it.
You know, I get like really into it, you know. And people in other countries, they don't understand why Americans won't play the penalty game. Where like other players, they'll like get tapped a little bit and they'll fall and they'll try to draw a penalty for the other team by maybe acting out, maybe dramatizing a little bit what happened to them on the field. And the reason why Americans won't do it is because if we did that, no one would come to our games. Americans do not, they don't care what happened as long as you get back up.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's fascinating.
I love that about us.
Funny. I guess maybe I'm just more bitter. And I'm just like, I just don't feel that. I feel, especially as a gay man, I feel like it's just been, I don't know. I'm going to get banned from America, I guess, because I'm like, I just don't like it here. And I'm just like, I do get back up. And I'm still like, I'm going to go far with a more positive approach.
I mean, it's that Pete. It's children of immigrants, we have that too, right? There's a Pete Buttigieg gay, right? That like you were like, I have to be perfect to be allowed to take up space. You know, like I have to be four times as good to be equal, right? I have to fly to even be allowed to be in the room. I have to be, and all of that is true, but it doesn't mean you're not allowed to fail. It just means you may have to fail many more times before you get there. And I'm not saying that's a just or equitable way of doing things, but it is, I don't believe that it's true that in America, you're not allowed to fail.
I like that analogy. Now that you said that, she said Pete Buttigieg, I'm like, I'm listening. Cause I remember being like, this isn't going to happen, you guys. And everybody was like, oh no, it can. I'm like, no, it can't. And then, and on paper, like who else do you want? A veteran speaks how many languages, can play how many instruments. And you know, he failed. But that's okay because he came back and he's going to run again. And I can see him continue to try. And, you know, so, yeah. Thank you, because Ivy Lee. I made me feel a little better about my country.
Yeah, he's probably going to run again because, like, people don't mind that. People don't mind that he failed. I mind white men who keep getting back up and running. But not because specifically because of any American cultural more. It's just more like, okay, I get it. You're allowed to fail more. Like, come on.
Yeah. So. Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So, Ivy, what was the path? Because I imagine you're doing poetry, you're doing spoken word in Atlanta. Was the spoken word what caused you to get into stand-up comedy?
No. Comedy happened to me like in the last 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Comedy.
Okay.
Oh.
Comedy was never for me. Comedy is still hardly for me.
It's hard shit.
No, not because of its difficulty. I mean, difficulty is fine, like whatever, you know. But because, I mean, comedy is largely full of misogyny, racism, homophobia. Also, like pedophilia, jokes like against homeless people. I mean, like just like isms, and we don't even have names for because the rest of the world doesn't experience them as much as people do in like comedy. I did not grow up. What I did grow up with a lot of black sitcoms, which inform the way that I speak. Because I was, because I grew up in the middle of the city, Dallas, Texas, and then I lived in Atlanta for most of my reckless youth. You know, I spoke English, what people today would call a black scent, but I think most black people who live in communities in the South, they just like know how diverse these communities are. They can see that like I'm not faking it. It's the white voice that I'm faking. Right?
That's the code switch.
Right. That's the code switch. Because that was all the English that was spoken around me. That's like how I learned how to speak in English, right? It's like how I learned how to be American was from Black Americans, because that's who I was. Those are the only Americans for a long time that I was going to school with, you know? And so, and really, even where I was going, where I grew up, the white people sounded like that too. Do you know what I mean? We just kind of, a lot of times people think you've got like a Black scent today on YouTube or whatever, but maybe they're not from the United States, or like a lot of people from the South are like, that's just how people from the South talk, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's just how we talk and how we sing and how we do comedy. And you know, growing up, you know, we were allowed to have like two famous black comics, and then a bunch of like sitcoms and a couple like sketch shows, but then like everyone else was like a white dude. And then we had a few white women, but like Ellen got canceled when she came out, Margaret Cho's show got canceled after one season, and like Roseanne, and I think that was kind of, you know, Janine Garofalo, she acted in comedies or whatever, but there was no reason for me to think that stand-up comedy was gonna be a space for me. Mm-hmm. So I came to stand-up comedy because I consider myself a spoken word artist for a really long time, poet and a storyteller. I told a story at a sex positive storytelling show here called Bedpost Confessions. There's also a podcast that comes from the live show, and my story is on that podcast if you want to hear it. And it was about sexuality after childbirth. And afterwards, I had people coming up to me, not saying you should try stand-up comedy, you might be really good at it. People came up to me and they're like, obviously you are a professional stand-up comic and I love stand-up comedy and I just want to know where to buy tickets to your show. And at the time, I was desperately unemployed. It had been very difficult for me to get back into the workforce after having my second child. I was having a really hard time and I was like, I have to change careers. I had gone to MBA school. I mean, this is how much I did not think I was an artist. I went to MBA school. Okay. I, you know, my career path changed after that, or I was trying to change my career path. I was able to get a fellowship in education reform. But then for a long time, I got contracts here and there, but I couldn't get full-time work. I was really struggling. And so when mm-hmm. people were begging to give me their money so that they could hear more of my quote unquote comedy, which was just me talking honestly about how my body changed and what sex was like after childbirth and getting used to that and trying to understand that for myself, just an honest experience about my life, people thought was hysterical. Well, I'm glad my life, I'm glad that the trials and tribulations of my life people find entertaining. But the point is I was really not in a position to turn down career ideas at that point.
Sure.
In my life. And sure. So I was also really lucky. That was around the time that Hannah Gadsby's Nanette came out and like shook the comedy world, right? There were all these think pieces about like, is this really comedy or isn't it? Didn't matter. Once I started researching it, because I was not too proud to just outright reject this career idea or any career idea at that point. Once I started mm-hmm. researching, I found artists like Hannah Gadsby. I found artists like Ali Sadiq down the road in Houston. I've never met him. I hope I get to because he's inspired me a lot. When I see recently Moses Storm, new special Trash White that came out recently, when I see works like this, I'm like, oh, they're obviously being filed under comedy special, mm-hmm. despite what the think pieces are. Okay, these are comedy specials. And if these are comedy, then I make comedy. Now I understand why everybody's like, oh, you're a stand-up comic. If these things are comedy, then I am a stand-up comic. And it really sure. doesn't matter. Even if the stuff is only 1% of comedy, doesn't matter. I make comedy. And it doesn't really matter if the other 99% is like misogynistic, transphobic, racist, trash. Right? It really does not matter. Right. My thing is just what it is. And that's how I became.
And I would wager it's more important to have that diversity of content, of comedy content, in order to continue to change the tide so that not everything is homophobic, misogynistic, racist bullshit.
I was working in narrative change. So it was like PR and political science. And like, that was kind of like my field, kind of the intersection of the two for a really long time. A lot of people would call what I was doing narrative change. Like, I've worked at the Texas Civil Rights Project, for example. That's like, most people outside of Texas hadn't heard about the Texas Civil Rights Project until families were getting separated at our border during the right. Trump administration, right? Most people didn't know about their kind of work and stuff. I did narrative change. Narrative change is kind of where you help kind of open the window of what is possible in public discourse. Like for example, it's Pride Month. Let's talk about like, you know, how we shifted from how we were able to shift the debate about whether or not gay people should be allowed to marry moved it into a position of very like legal focused or whatever, and just kind of explained to people like, this is really just kind of at the bottom line, it's just kind of about love. It's just something mm-hmm. people understand, right? Whether or not they think that they know a gay person or not, they're like, oh, like, you understand what love is. Okay, now we have the shared understanding. Let's talk about the implications yes. of love on this, you know, and like kind of helping people understand these things so that they can grasp problems in a way that we can take action on them. Cultural change is what I do now as an artist. Already, I feel like I was able to achieve more in like 3 years of comedy than I was able to achieve in like 16 years of narrative change. Yes.
The capitalism change is nothing. It keeps the loop going. Cultural change, yes. So you're off doing PR, you're doing a little bit of spoken word, everything, and along the way, a life changes, you become a mother. Was that part of the plan? Did you always want to be one? Or is that, how did that change you as a person, as an artist, the course of your life?
Well, I mean, it thrust me into comedy, like I just said. It made the stakes of my career much higher.
It actually became an inspiration. And later down the road, the becoming a mother, would you say that?
I mean, if being an artist is creation, I would say, you know, making two new people is quite. So, I mean, in the technical sense, they yes. are works of art in a way. Yes, technically, yes, they did make me more of an artist. But beyond that, I don't know that it did. What do you mean?
Well, I know a couple of people who use, like Brie writes about her children. She writes about being a mother. She writes about the pratfalls and the pitfalls. And obviously you use like your body after having children, which catapulted your comedy. Like, do you look to motherhood a lot as inspiration for your...
I think I look to life. Like, do you feel like people who don't have children don't make art about their lives without children?
Oh, no. I mean, I don't have children. I mean, I sit down and look at myself and how I'm feeling, what I'm thinking in the world around me. It was a new point of inspiration for you to be like, oh, well, this is, I'm going to talk about this. And like, because this is a whole new aspect I never knew.
You know how like people just interview people who are just like regular humans, then they mm-hmm. interview like Asian American humans during Asian American History Month. And then it's like, or like they'll interview like regular directors, but then they'll interview like a woman director and they'll be like, what's it like making, you know, movies like as a woman? Right. And they don't ask about like the movie or whatever. I don't think that whenever I draw inspiration from my life, I don't think that it's different from people who draw inspiration from lives that are different from mine, whether that is specifically about being a parent or that's specifically about their culture. People would be like, oh, like your art has all this like cultural elements to it. And I'm like, white people's art is about white culture. Seinfeld mm-hmm. is a show about white culture.
Sure.
Did it change my art? No, it's my life. My life is, you know, my life is where I draw anything from my art. But that like literally is, if I didn't have children in my life, it would be the exact same. It would inform my work in the exact same measure. An equal mm-hmm. amount of measure. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But people who don't have children are not writing art separately from not having children any more than Seinfeld was able to make art that was separate from his race and cultural experience.
It has to inform your art because suddenly it is your experience.
Right. Everybody's experience informs their art.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? And I think we notice it more, not just because people point it out more, because there's always this implication of like, well, who's watching your children? You know, there's that added like kind of aspect to it. The reason why people notice it more is because in general, we don't allow women with children to like exist in public space. We don't want their children to eat in public restaurants. We don't want, you know, every time, like I told you right after MBA school, I worked in education reform. I was an education pioneer fellow mm-hmm. after graduate school. They only take people who have done graduate school. So people with graduate degrees get placed in education reform organizations and kind of for very little money, contribute some project that this usually a nonprofit wouldn't have otherwise been able to afford. And then we get to make this like outsized impacts, you know, hopefully in education reform. That year in my class, Texas fellows, every state, like the kind of states kind of organize themselves, you know, in Texas, when we all would get together for our big conferences to like meet each other and get training and stuff like that. I think my class was something like 35 people ish, give or take. I can't remember the exact number, right? But it was about that size. In the entire group, I was the only mother of young children in education reform.
Oof.
Oh my God.
So not because of my age. Everybody else is my age, right? There were definitely women whose children were adults, and then like one or two other dads of young children, but the women, none of the women who were participating had children. And I brought a very different, that brings a very different energy to the room. You know, when people put out a plan and I say, hey, this plan is going to take too long to work, I got like 4 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We need to scrap this plan. Or if we can't, or if this is all, if all the plans are going to take five generations or whatever to work, then I have to leave the nonprofit sector because now I have to go bust my butt to go make a bunch of money to protect my children because obviously these plans are not going to do it for them. You know, this work in education reform is not going to do it. But every single space, whether it's a podcast space, whether I'm speaking on an issue at City Hall or the Texas legislature, you know, which periodically, like I do work like that, I'm almost always the only mom of young children, like not adult children who have left the house. I'm almost always the only mom in these spaces. There's a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we notice. That's why Ali Wong got to, the women have been, people have been giving birth for a really long time, right? And we've had media.
Just a really long time. We've been doing that.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's absurd and hilarious. But Ali Wong in like this century got to blow up by doing a comedy special on it, which is great. But like, we could have had that like 100 years ago.
I remember seeing her special and she was like 9 months pregnant. She was brilliant. And I remember like some of the blowback she got for being like, and I was like, why is it a problem if she's pregnant and doing stand-up? Like, it's what she's doing right now.
Yeah,
like,
it's not boxing. It's stand-up comedy. Yeah.
Like, people have been pregnant, you know.
She's not lugeing. Like, she's not doing cross-country skiing at the Olympics, guys. Relax. She's walking around on a stage making you laugh. Like, what the fuck?
And I bet you Ali Wong probably could luge, though. 9 months pregnant. She's brilliant.
Ivy, I'm curious too, because we talked about it at the top. Your podcast, Fear of Going Outside, FOGO, everybody look it up wherever podcasts
podcasts are streamed. It's a Spotify Studios. What, you were chosen out of many, many people to create this podcast, and we're so glad that you were. What was the trajectory from then, comedy 3 or 4 years ago, and then you decided, I want to make this podcast? What was the inspiration for Fear of Going Outside? Aside from Fear of Going Outside.
Nice. I wanted to make a show that was where my point of view was really material to the show, but I didn't want to make a show about my trauma. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
yes. Totally.
Like, yeah. I already did that to get into college. I feel like my dues are paid, you know?
I've lit enough for you. Thank you.
I've sold enough of my trauma, right, to succeed. I think I'm done with that. So, and I realized nature is a very culturally specific construct, and I'm obsessed with nature shows. I love nature shows. I love the cheesy ones like Naked and Afraid. I love the highbrow BBC documentaries. I started doing drugs during the pandemic.
Congratulations.
Marijuana. And
is that a drug?
I think the politically correct term for it now is cannabis.
Yes.
But I live in Texas where it's called marijuana. And I really love, you know, having my little edible and then watching just like a sweeping nature documentary and just being just really absorbing just the magnificence, the majesty of like planet Earth, you know. there's one about this little tiny fish's like odyssey across the reef that if you watch it high, you're just like just consumed with this little fish's like survival.
Adorable. I love the Barack Obama narrating about the national parks. Mm-hmm. It's on Netflix if you haven't watched it and you like to partake in the cannabis.
I love river monsters and yes. Monster bug war, like just the cheesy stuff, the best stuff, everything in between, the game shows. I love them. So I pitched this show to Spotify as part of the Spotify Sound Up Podcast Accelerator for Women of Color podcasters. And 18,000 people applied and only 10 were going to get in. But I was super lucky. I got in. The people found the topic really compelling, largely because even though I think most people are super scared of nature, and that's why we invented cities, you've never heard that perspective before in media. There's definitely like a pro, you know, nature bias, I think, in media.
I'm definitely in that. I know. I mean, the only time I've ever been camping is like Sex in the Rambles at Central Park. I mean, that's not a snake scare me, bugs scare me. I can't. I'm like, so when you were talking about the premise of your show, I'm like sitting here sweating like, oh my God, I mean, nature, you went out in nature. Like, oh Lord.
It was terrible. It was terrible.
And you conquered it.
Like, and I think when you spoke at the Outlier Podcast Fest, I related because my parents are immigrants as well. And like, I remember having all my white friends growing up, they were like, we're going to go camping. And like all my friends knew how to pitch a tent. And my parents are like, we don't fucking go in the woods. Like, do you know how hard we worked to like be able to pay for a motel?
Like, and we like, came to America on a lawn chair, bitch. No.
surfboard and a weed whacker 90 miles from Cuba to Key West. Like, what the fuck? We're going to go into the woods and sleep on the floor?
No.
Like, it was not we did not camp. I did not camp as a child. So like, I never had that experience.
We could have just slept on the floor in a sugar plantation back in Cuba.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what's the point of this?
I didn't find communism at scale to go sleep on the floor in the woods. Like, it's not what we're about. So I really identified with the topic from that perspective. But please continue. Let's talk Fear of Going Outside. So Spotify loved it. And I'm not surprised.
Well, so I got into the camp, but that week long accelerator, it was only a week at the time. Now it's formatted a little bit differently. At the end, the way it culminated was that we did a pitch competition for some seed money to make your pilot, and I wasn't one of the people who won any seed money. I didn't win it. But I made some really great friendships with women of color storytellers who are just like really incredible in that class, and that pretty much, you know, made it all worth it for me. So then my brother and I did a Kickstarter to raise money to kind of get not just my camping equipment, but obviously my sound recording equipment. I didn't have any sound recording equipment. And we had to really trial and error what was going to work, because most quote unquote podcaster sound equipment doesn't really work well out in the wild, the literal wild. So
I'm fascinated by that. Yeah.
And then once I made my pilot, the pandemic started. And when the pandemic started, I had already been struggling in comedy, because it's not that my kids like inspired me like to do comedy, but, you know, but when you're a mom, it's illegal to leave them at night, even when they're just sleeping. Highly illegal. Yeah, you can go to jail. So, like, I mean, legally, I just really couldn't get a whole lot of time. I couldn't get a lot of stage time. So,
and you did this, you filmed this in the Texas heat too. Like, you do this in the wild in like the hot. Like, is there a special time of year that it's better to do?
There is, but I didn't find out any of that until after I was done. So I did end up camping in July in Texas.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. You should listen to it. Fear of going outside. Let me know what
you
think.
Up in July.
Oh my God. It's so, what have you learned to, because you're, how many seasons now? What season are you? Are you still working on season two or are you coming to three?
I'm in production on season two. And two, season right. two is about hunting.
That's what
Oh my God.
I can't wait for this.
So I'm a hunter now.
How is one a self-taught hunter? Is that safe? I'm like, God.
I don't think it's that safe, but you'll have to listen to season two to find out. I hope it'll drop starting at the beginning of the year in 2023.
Well, this is a perfect segue, Ivy. It is shameless plug time. Obviously, Fear of Going Outside is your fantastic podcast. What else are you working on that you want to sort of tell the audience about? Where can people find you? How can people listen to you?
You can listen to me anywhere you listen to podcasts, not just on Spotify, but it is totally free on Spotify, and it is easier for me to see the stats if you do listen to it on Spotify. That's FOGO, Fear of Going Outside. You can also find me on Instagram and TikTok and Twitter, I mean all the social media, at Ivy Lee with one E, as in it's literally spelled, that phrase is spelled out, Ivy Lee. W-I-T-H, like with one O-N-E-E, right? It's that phrase, Ivy Lee with one E. You can find me pretty much everywhere. And I would love it if people would follow me on Instagram. Follow me on Instagram. I love Instagram. Right. And I always wish I could interact with more. I could always wish I could interact with more people who love comedy, people who want to decolonize everything and like make it comedy. I want to interact with more people like that on Instagram. So please follow me there. And I am looking for a manager for I'm looking for literary management for a script I'm writing about a ninja who tries to level up her life by going to coding camp, and I can
obsessed.
Be found and I do stand-up comedy all over Austin, and I think once kind of pandemic stuff finally settles down, my family actually almost all of us just got COVID, so once pandemic stuff really legitimately calms down, all the young children are vaccinated, I hopefully will be coming to a comedy festival near you.
Yay, we love that. We love that.
That.
We
can't.
Do you have any like series too in Austin that people that are local to Austin, do you have any specific like comedy like places that you perform?
Yeah, so every month I host the only queer comedy open mic in town. It usually has a feature too, and the show is free. It's the first Thursday of every month at Swan Dive on Red River downtown. And I perform pretty regularly at Fallout Theater, which is kind of, after the pandemic, kind of our main like improv and sketch theater now. Cold Town used to be my home, and so Cold Town will have events at other theaters. But I open for a lot of improv troupes because I love improvisers. And I just started performing with a troupe that plays at Fallout called 48. And if you're in New York City, you check out, there's actually an all Asian American sketch group called Model Majority. And I just did a show with them just last month, and I periodically be dropping in with them too.
Oh, I love that. Yay.
That's amazing.
That's fantastic.
How is your Pride Month? How are you celebrating? Just by living. I'm trying to just live my best Pride life. But
I'm barely making it. I didn't get to do a whole lot of Pride because I was traveling and with the summers and stuff. But I still have a few days left to celebrate Pride as a raging bisexual mom. What should I do?
One way locally for me and you know, Ivy, one way you could celebrate is that there's a local LGBTQ center in my hometown in Durham, North Carolina. And I love to, I'm an administrative volunteer, so I just like work the front desk, and they're opening a youth center. So if anybody has an LGBTQ center or an LGBTQ organization or community center, donate, go volunteer. We're super excited here in Durham because they're opening a youth center for just kids that need help to just come be and live and have a safe space. That's a great way. Volunteerism is a great way to sort of give back during Pride.
It's always a good start to head to the HRC website, which is the Human Rights Campaign, and glad.org, because they have comprehensive lists of everything in the states and the cities and the counties of where everybody, they break it down to help break it down, where everybody wants to give money or where the best places to go and volunteer and to find resources. So,
and yeah, what are your favorite LGBTQ organizations in Texas, Ivy?
TENT is the Trans Education Network. One of the T is trans, and one of the T's is Texas. TENT, and they do a lot of, they kind of are one of the big leaders of the fight for trans rights here, because people are constantly, our state ledge is constantly attacking trans kids specifically. And so they've kind of been kind of a clearinghouse of like where people can go if they're a social worker and they need training, or if they're a parent and they need resources, if they're just like an organization that needs to understand like how these issues intersect with what they're doing. They are not nearly funded enough. So actually, please donate to TENT, because we need it. We need it so bad here. And it's really hard to get that kind of work funded. Just anywhere, but in Texas, people who are kind of out to set precedent and attack the existence of trans people, they do a lot of that work here first in Texas, because we have like four of the largest cities in America are in Texas. So if they can figure out a way to do it here, they can then roll it out everywhere else. And they've done that with immigrant rights. They've done that with criminal injustice. They've done that with voting rights. They've done that with a lot of things in Texas. So if you're not in Texas and you have ever said to yourself, oh, wow, like Texas got problems, you know, please donate to TENT.
That's great. Thank you so much, Ivy. This was a blast. We had so much fun talking to you, and we so appreciate you taking the time to talk a little bit about yourself and talk a little bit about your journey as an artist. I think people are going to be super inspired. And thank you so much as a raging bisexual mother for joining us, and human being and lovely person. For joining us during Pride.
I imagine you're going to up the interest in going outside once your show gets bigger and bigger. I see you like you leading a revolution of people like, let's go outside with Ivy. It won't be me. But
you'd be surprised. A lot of LGBTQ people here in Central Texas, because we post a lot. So I post a lot of updates about the hunting production on at Fogo Podcast on Instagram. A lot of people, LGBTQ people, have come to me since I started production on season two, asking about how they could go hunting me, and it's given me some really good ideas. And I think we're gonna make. I think once the season launches, I'm going to make an LGBTQ hunt happen.
Hell yes. Three
Please
snaps.
Be careful. In Texas, in the swamplands, in the hole. Oh my God. I just don't see this ending well, but oh God.
This sounds like a TV show.
It is. Your creativity, it knows no bounds, and I love it. And you're the ultimate unusual creature. And so thank you for joining us.
Thanks for reclaiming that, guys. I can't wait till I'm like more famous and I can get to come back.
Yes. We would love to have you anytime. Famous, not famous, however that is defined, please. We can't wait to talk more and dig in.
You two could run out and I'll narrate an episode of you two out in the woods if that's where that's the best I can get. I was just like, I can't go out there.
Come on out.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Ivy, for giving us your time. I know you're very busy and I've got a lot going on. So thank you for giving. And Jennifer.
Everybody, you guys know the drill. Thank you for listening to the Unusual Creatures podcast. Subscribe, tell your friends, drop us an email. We really love feedback. UnusualCreaturesPod@gmail.com is where you can find us. Tom really wants to find his stalker. I know he's out there. So please email Tom, because I'm sick of hearing him talk about it. He wants the Twitter trolls. He wants the stalkers. Anyways, you guys know what to do, fam. Leave us a review, throw us a line, follow us on Instagram, follow Ivy Lee with one E on Instagram. Make sure you check out Fear of Going Outside or FOGO on Spotify. Keep spreading those links, y'all.
And thank you, Jennifer, for doing this Pride Month series with me. Thank you to thank you to all of our guests, but specifically month's guests who gave so much of themselves and their generosity. It's still a scary world to be part of our Rainbow Coalition community. And the more we talk, the more help we can put out there, the more good we can put out there, the more knowledge we can put out there. And it's always the best choice. So go out there, be gay, be your guest, be your best self. And make some great art, everybody.
And next week, back to your regularly scheduled programming. Just because it's not Pride doesn't mean we're not still going to have a ton of gay motherfuckers on the show. We absolutely will. But this month is obviously a little special. So thank you so much for listening. And Tom, I'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye.
Happy Pride.
Thanks so much for listening to The Unusual Creatures. We love telling the stories of these creatives, and we hope you love listening to them.
You know the drill. Subscribe where you love listening to pods. Send links to your friends and tell everyone you know about this show. And I mean everyone. Counting the minutes until we meet again. And
keep being unusual creatures. Fuck it.